It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the House January 6th committee is recommending criminal charges against former President Donald Trump. We'll look at today's final public hearing and what comes next. First, the college paper or persuasive essay are common ways to grade students in college, sometimes in high school as well. And now the school paper may be turned upside down because of generative AI, so-called artificial intelligence. Advanced chatbot technology is here. It can write papers and make itself look pretty smart, smart enough that it can be prompted to write papers that some would consider B-plus material. It's likely to get better. Our next guest says the educational system needs to figure out how to respond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the rise of this type of technology? Have you encountered it yourself in your job as a student or as a teacher, maybe yourself? Do you think that we need to change the way we evaluate students from the essay to what? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Stephen Marsh is a novelist and essayist. He's the author of several books, including The Next Civil War and The Unmade Bed. His latest piece in The Atlantic is called The College Essay is Dead. Stephen, welcome back to Central Time.
Pleasure to be with you, Rob.
You've been following and writing about this generative AI and other similar products for some time now. When it comes to coming up with documents that look like term papers, say, give us a sense of how quickly this technology has been emerging lately.
Well, I mean, it's the kind of thing where I sort of have my mind blown about once every 2 weeks. You know, like, it's just one of those things like, oh, you can do that now? Like, oh, my God. I mean, I would say the moment I had where I really had my mind blown was about 2 years ago, where I was using an application called PseudoWrite, which allows you to use GPT-3 to create writing. And I asked it to finish the poem Kubla Khan by Samuel Taylor Coleridge, like, you know, in Xanadu to Kubla Khan, a stately pleasure dome to Crete, you know, that whole poem that was famously unfinished. And it finished it, and it was completely convincing. And it was like, it was like if somebody told me that Coleridge had written that, I would believe it. And I think everyone else would believe it, too. So I've been sort of like, I think the past couple of weeks, as ChatGPT has shown up, people are really starting to understand the power of this stuff. But I have, you know, I knew from that moment that the undergraduate essay was more or less doomed.
Now, GPT-3, ChatGPT, can you talk a little bit about how it works? It's not, I mean, we say artificial intelligence. It's not intelligent artificially or otherwise. What's it doing?
Okay. So I've talked to an engineer who invented Transformer. I've talked to like people who did Palm at Google, which has 540 billion parameters. I don't feel like I'm an idiot. But on the other hand, I don't want to deceive your listeners into thinking that I can describe this in an accurate way that would be technically accurate. The most important thing to remember is that all it is text prediction software. All it does is it creates what is the most logical continuation of a passage, right? And so that's all that it does. And to do that, I mean, to give it in the most crude description, it searches language for patterns of coherence. These are the parameters, and then applies them to make more coherent language. So when you have something like GPT-3, which has 175 billion parameters, that has incredible powers. But when you get to something like Google's Palm, which has 540 billion parameters, it can do things like low-level reasoning, and where you can instruct it using parables and things like that, and it will learn from them. And yeah, and it gets crazy the higher the number of parameters go and the more sophisticated the intelligence gets.
All right, here I am, an undergraduate student. It's been a day or two, but pretend. Papers due. So what do I input? What do I get out if I try to have these programs, these systems write my paper for me?
Well, let's take an example. I mean, off the top of my head, what do the three witches in Macbeth mean, and how do they relate to the action of the play, right? Like, typical. Does that sound like an undergraduate question to you?
Sure.
Yeah, you go to ChatGPT-3, you put in that exact question, you say, write this in the style of that, and it produces it. You know, you would then have to fact check it, then you'd have to correct it, but it would definitely give you a strong, say, well, however many words you asked for. So like if you asked it for 1,000 words, it would give you 1,000 words on that question, and they would be pretty good.
And you looked at a paper written by one of these, by somebody else who'd input parameters. What did it look like something that you could read and say, yeah, maybe a human wrote this, then did a decent job?
Yeah, but, I've been a professor, so I remember grading undergraduate papers, and like many of them were totally incoherent, right? This was quite coherent, right? But I think you have to understand, like, there are a number of examples going around, but, you know, I have a friend who's using this because his kids in French immersion here, because we're in Canada, and they don't have enough of a particular kind of children's book that his kid likes. So he's gone to ChatGPT and said, can you write this story in French for my 6-year-old son to read? And it does it, and the kid reads it, right? I mean, we're entering a world of a fundamentally different relation to text production.
Talking to Stephen Marsh, he wrote a piece in The Atlantic called The College Essay is Dead. Why? Because these online systems, these generative learning AI systems, can write papers that look pretty plausible for college, maybe even high school. You can join in with your questions if you have experiences with this, if you have concerns about what it could mean for education and beyond. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Stephen, a big point of your piece is, hey, higher education, I'm guessing high school education too, get ready for this. What do you want to see the teachers and professors and administrators thinking about?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, I'm not paid the big bucks. I'm not a university administrator. I don't have to deal with this problem. I just have to point it out. Like, actually dealing with it seems to me like an incredible quagmire that I have no idea how to solve. I mean, I actually think the only, because, you know, what this doesn't end is not the craft of writing, or necessarily the craft of shaping an argument or finding intention in an argument, which is very different. But the confrontation with the blank page, like a student just being like, I have to write 1500 words. Here's a blank computer screen. I have to fill it. That first draft, I think that's really dead. And so the question then becomes, you know, is this even cheating? Because it's a tool. You're not using somebody else's intelligence. It's not cheating to use a thesaurus or spell check. Is this even cheating? I mean, that's one question that you have to deal with. But I actually think like methods of evaluation are going to have to change. I mean, I think the take-home exam is pointless at this point. But I also think like things like oral exams are going to return. Like where you're actually talking to students and figuring out what they know from talking to them, that is also going to return, because simply seeing an undergraduate essay is not going to mean that they composed it.
I remember in high school, something I really resented for a term paper was I had to, you know, first list some of the sources and start outlines and basically show my work in stages as the semester went on. Is that a method you think could defeat this?
That's a smart teacher, right? Yeah. I mean, like, I think there are techniques for dealing with this. And I do think the essay, I mean, you know, I have made my living basically from writing essays my whole life, but I do think it is an important step in learning how to think through things and learning how to research things and learning how to figure things out in your own mind and how to put them down in a way that is communicable to other people. I think it is important just simply as a technique to master for other things. I think there's going to be a lot of approaches like that the teachers are going to have to take, because just simply like grading like the same a bunch of papers that come in and the students have done them in the privacy of their own home, I think that's going to be, you know, that's not going to register what you think it's registering anymore.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Kylie is with us in Sparta. Kylie, hi.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
So what I wanted to say is I'm currently finishing my master's degree in special education. Just finishing. Tomorrow's my last day of student teaching. And I'm going through Grand Canyon University in Arizona. It's an online course. What I was telling the person that answers the phones is, for our work, we have to send it in for a similarity report, and that looks through the entire web of, information where things are generated, and we can't have a higher similarity score than 20%. So when you have these websites that create these documents, then they're, you know, they're saved. And so then if you're copying it, it's going to show 100%. You can't turn it in.
Kylie, thanks for that call. More power to you. My mom is a retired special ed teacher, so you're doing good work there. Thank you, and congrats on finishing student teaching. Stephen, she's talking about that plagiarism check that is done online. And maybe that would work here. It's not exactly plagiarism, but if everybody's social or special ed final paper looks kind of the same because it came from the same programs, it's going to start ringing some bells?
Well, you know, I think so this stuff doesn't register on Turnitin.com. ChatGPT, there's been some talk that they are going to actually like provide every code, essentially put a code in for each block of text produced, which would allow an institution or a university to check against it. Right? Like to check whether it has actually been produced by ChatGPT. I'm sure, you know, ChatGPT-3 is not the only technology capable of doing this. There are other programs out there, Jasper AI, my favorite Cohere in Toronto, like that do the similar stuff with similar effects. So, you know, finding an irresponsible large language model is not going to be particularly difficult for anybody. But then I also would point out that I don't think a smart student would use this as a like they would just put it in and then take whatever came out, because first of all, sometimes the machines hallucinate, right? Like every now and then they produce an answer that is completely unrelated to reality, right? Mm-hmm. And that would get you an F, right? So what this would be used for is that you generate this text and it would essentially be a first draft generator that then you would check, and then you would fool around with the language and the wording and make your own in some way. And that's what it would do to me, rather than just completely create a whole text that you would just, you know, hand in after 5 minutes. It would actually just reduce the hardest process, part of the writing process, which is the first draft.
Kylie, thanks for the call. We are talking to novelist and essayist Stephen Marsh about the disruptive power of generative AI computer systems that can now compile things that look a lot like college essays, maybe even a high school paper, and produce things that look like art, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how this could change education? Do you have thoughts on this if you work with students at any level? Do you have concerns about what this could mean if a computer basically could generate their paper for them, ideally with a bit of redrafting along the way? Call it at 800-642-1234. Do you see positive uses of this human and AI-like thing working together? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with novelist and essayist Stephen Marsh, talking about his latest piece for The Atlantic. It's called "The College Essay is Dead. Nobody's prepared for how AI will transform academia." There are systems and algorithms where you input some ideas and talking points and it generates the length of paper that you want. How does that change education? Does it? Call 800-642-1234 with your reactions, your questions. If you've been able to play around with some of these things yourself, love to hear about your experience at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Stephen, you get into a deeper point in that essay about kind of a divide that's growing between what we think of as the humanities and technology world. And you say, these kind of things may force them to talk to each other again. Can you talk about that a little?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're dealing with the technology of language, right? And specifically of the aesthetics of language in a really, you know, fascinating way. I do think the two sides, at least from my experience, are quite removed on this point. You have technologists who, you know, don't really understand literature, don't really understand history, you know, just or regard humanistic questions as like, you know, everybody's entitled to an opinion kind of questions. And then you have humanities, on the other hand, who are, you know, still engaged in pretty navel-gazing debates about their own relevance and also resistant to technology and, you know, engaged in a refusal to see its potential. But I think this technology is so wonderful. I mean, I really am a big fan. Like, I know we do these pieces where it's like we're afraid of things and it's going to ruin the essay, but I actually think this is going to be a marvelous technology that's going to create very beautiful, fascinating things, and is going to create new art forms and new genres of expression. And I think everyone's going to see that when these two sides get together, it's going to be magic. And I mean, that may sound utopian, but I actually think that both sides kind of recognize that that's where their future lies for both of them.
I've seen arguments in the past before we had these kind of programs about ways humans can embrace technology. I think the word centaur came up, kind of get the best of both worlds. As a creator, as a writer yourself, what are some of your visions for how that beauty could come out of this?
Well, I mean, it hasn't been published yet, but I've just written a short story with an engineer at Cohere where it's a prompt story. So we built it on prompts, like do this, do that throughout, and then trained it on examples. And it creates an infinitely regenerative story. So it's the same piece of fiction. It's the same characters. It's the same thing, but it's different every time. It's expressed differently every time. That's just me fooling around with an engineer, right? Like I think there's, like I did write an entirely automatically generated short story for LitHub recently, and one that was 17% computer generated for the LA Review of Books. I mean, I think this is a whole new approach to making language that's going to have, I don't think we know what it is yet. I don't think we've seen the kind of creative chatbots that are going to emerge from this, but they're coming. And I think if we don't mess it up too badly, they could be wonderful.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So, Rob, I have a question. How are you even certain that your guest wrote his article? I mean, you know, I'm kidding, obviously, but, you know, if it can do this, why wouldn't it change everything from, you know, pieces, editorial pieces in newspapers to magazine articles to everything else? And it's just, there's no independent thought, you know. That being said, I will say that, you know, the Bible refers to it. It says nothing's new under the sun. You know, there's always so many storylines. So, I mean, this has kind of been sort of a problem that's been going on all along, too.
Marcus, thanks a lot for that call. Now, I've seen experiments with generating, say, oh, we need to write up all our high school sports results and we don't have any reporters anymore. Feed in the stats. It writes up a thing.
Right.
There are rip-off sites that take other people's news sites, paraphrase them, and write quote-unquote new articles. I don't know. Stephen, it could be that there is a news article out there that's written, generated this way, and we don't know about it.
Well, a big piece that I wrote for the Atlantic like 3 months ago called Of Gods and Machines, like not to spoil the thing too much, but two-thirds of the way through, I put in computer generated text and then I revealed afterwards, like actually this part was computer generated and no one noticed, right? Like my editors didn't notice. They didn't say like, oh, you can't have that stuff in, right? Like, because that's obviously wrong. It's like, no, that it sounded and looked exactly like me, right? So like this is definitely coming, but you know, I would also remind you that this is just text prediction software. So it doesn't have any intention. Right. It doesn't have a will. It is not like when you write an essay, you're actually willing something into existing. You're intending a meaning to come into existence. And a computer can't do that. Computer has no intention. It's just an algorithm. It's a series of instructions. Right. And so, you know, like, I don't think this is going to take any jobs away from anyone at all. Genuinely. Like, I think it's going to be a tool that people are going to use, but, you know, I don't think it's going to destroy writing. What, you know, we live in a world with a lot of fake text in it anyway. I mean, I get letters all the time that says, "Dear Mr. Marsh, you are one of our most valued customers," right? That kind of language is totally, you know, it may as well be written by a machine anyway. So like that kind of language, like, for example, low-level legal contracts, things like this, that language is going to be seriously challenged by ChatGPT and other text generators. But writing, like, I think writing is going to matter more than ever.
Thanks a lot for that call, Marcus. And Stephen, is this maybe a call to embrace a more unique voice when we speak and write and create art? Because I remember when I wrote school papers, I think the incentive was to make them really boring to fit the genre. Because that's something we need to get away from.
Well, I think what will matter is the intentionality, you know, because like the, you know, it's sort of like, I mean, when I was a kid, now this is a long time ago, but spelling really mattered. That was real evidence of something in your brain. Like they thought you were smart because you could spell, right? And that's gone, right? Like that is a historical artifact, right? And I think it will be the same with low-level craft of writing. Like just simply being able to make a coherent, cogent argument, which is not easy. Like people treat it like it's actually quite hard to do. That's about to become a lot easier simply from a technical point of view. So what will matter more is what you're expressing and what you intend and how you pierce a subject, you know, and how you look at things and how you observe them. I mean, but, you know, we're still in early days here. Like, you know, the other thing is like GPT-4 could come out, you know, 2 weeks from now, and then you'd have to have me back on the show to talk through all the consequences of that, because God knows what they'll be.
Stephen, we'll leave it there and watch for that. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Stephen Marsh, novelist and essayist. We talked to him today about the power of machine learning and generative AI to disrupt lots of stuff, potentially, including text-generating programs that could kill the college essay. But as you heard, he sees a lot of potential positive outcomes of it as well. Coming up after the news, the final public hearing from the January 6th committee concluded this afternoon with a recommendation for criminal charges against former President Trump. We'll talk to a Wisconsin political scientist about where things could go from here. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's the season to protect yourself against the flu and also your dog against the flu. Cases of canine influenza are growing in the United States. A veterinarian joins us to talk about the virus and how you can protect your pet. Now, the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol held its final public hearing this afternoon and approved the final report on its investigation. The hearing included a vote to refer criminal charges against former President Donald Trump to the Justice Department. Here's Republican Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming summarizing some of the committee's findings.
This was an utter moral failure and a clear dereliction of duty. Evidence of this can be seen in the testimony of President Trump's own White House counsel and several other White House witnesses. No man who would behave that way at that moment in time can ever serve in any position of authority in our nation again. He is unfit for any office.
Prior to today's hearing, Trump posted on social media that the committee members were, quote, thugs and scoundrels who are, quote, corrupt cowards who hate our country. The referral for charges leaves the Justice Department with a historic decision of whether or not to criminally prosecute a former U.S. president. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you watch or listen to this afternoon's event? What did you think? Have you been following these hearings over the last year and a half or so? Do you support the referral of charges against former President Trump? Should the Justice Department charge him with some or all of the crimes they listed? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. David Siemers is a professor of political science at UW Oshkosh. He's the author of several books and articles on the Constitution and the separation of power between Congress and the president. His most recent book is called The Myth of Co-Equal Branches, Restoring the Constitution's Separation of Functions. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be with you.
Well, can you talk about these criminal referrals? I think the big outcome of today, on the one hand, they have no force of law. The Justice Department would have to decide whether or not to act on them. On the other hand, this is kind of unprecedented territory, symbolically important. What do you make of it all?
Yeah, well, first, what is a criminal referral? And it's just when officials who can't charge someone with a crime find credible evidence of a crime and want to turn that over to the authorities who actually can prosecute that crime. And this happens fairly frequently. If state officials, for instance, find someone has committed a federal crime, they'll turn over information to the federal authorities so that they can be charged with a crime or decide whether that happens. So it happens all the time, but what's unusual about this is who's been, referred, right? Donald Trump, the former president, and for what? For actions that he took while he was president of the United States. So I was trying to cast around for maybe some historical precedent, and I have a couple things in mind, but there is really nothing quite like it.
What is in the neighborhood of precedent? Because, yeah, I've been racking my brain, too.
All right. So in the United States, let's go back to 1974, and you have a special prosecutor, Leon Jaworski, who is leading an investigation of the Watergate break-in and the associated cover-up. So that is on the executive side, but he's doing something that is kind of like a referral to Congress. He's saying to Congress, hey, the president was likely involved in a criminal conspiracy, and here are the charges that I would bring if I were the prosecutor. But you know what? He's the sitting president, and so you probably want to take a look at this first. And the clear implication from Jaworski is that the House committee should recommend impeachment, which it ultimately did, and that is what forced Nixon to resign. So that's a precedent in the United States. If we want to go way back in history, James I, monarch of England, 1642, is a kind of rogue monarch, according to people in the House of Commons. And he goes into the House of Commons in January of 1642, attempting to arrest five of their members on a charge of treason. He is rebuffed in this. The five members have been told to leave. And in the next few days, people in London are so incensed by what the king did that they kind of hound him out of town. And that's the beginning of the English Civil War. And ultimately, he's brought up on charges, and in 1649, that ends rather badly for James I.
I think it was Charles I. I'm an English Civil War nerd. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not a lot to work with now. And there's been this question all along, like, okay, can a sitting president be charged with crimes, or can only Congress impeach the president? Well, how about a former president? There's the argument with the second impeachment, you can impeach a former president. So can you charge a former president with crimes? Where are we on all that right now?
Well, surely you can charge a former president with crimes. The only reason that a sitting president is not charged with crimes is because there's a Department of Justice memo saying that that's bad policy for the Justice Department. And you can see why, because the Justice Department is officially underneath the president. So it creates all kinds of potential conflicts of interest. And, you know, it's probably better from a governance perspective or a separation of powers perspective to wait until after a president is out of office. I mean, Donald Trump said it as well as anyone, I suppose, or posed a really interesting question when he said that maybe he could shoot someone in the middle of Fifth Avenue in New York and get away with it for a time. Perhaps, at least according to the Department of Justice, that could happen, though that's a state crime. And, you know, then you have a president perhaps being prosecuted by a state. But the president wouldn't get away with that in the long run because the president is simply a private citizen after he leaves office.
We are talking to David Siemers from UW Oshkosh, looking at today's hearing, apparently final hearing of the January 6th committee in the U.S. House. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. The committee referred the former president to the Justice Department for a list of charges. Should former President Trump be charged? If so, with what? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234. Let's go to your calls. Will is with us in Eau Claire. Will, hi.
Afternoon, gentlemen. Well, it finally wraps up. The committee's done. A couple of comments. I had, like many, many people, hoped Mr. Trump would have been successful, but it turned out that he essentially is a scoundrel, you know, and we don't need to have, you know, attorneys tell us that. We saw it with our own eyes as a country on January the 6th, first time in our country's history that that kind of action has ever occurred. So whether or not he is found guilty or how this plays out, I think that all of us need to be careful about any kind of approval or sanction of this guy as a future office holder. Well, and he'll go down in infamy. So that's it. That's all I have to say. Thank
you. Thanks for that call. I mean, that follows up on what we heard from Representative Cheney there, saying that the former president is, quote, unfit for any office, unquote. Politically, even whether or not charges are filed, is our caller right that the message is out there?
Yeah, I think that's an important part of what the January 6th committee was doing, to lay out facts for the historical record. You know, whenever Congress acts or members of Congress act, it's not just about the good of the country. It's about politics as well. And I think, you know, Democratic members are probably also thinking of about politics. They can't help but do that. They're in that position. And so marginalizing Trump with a certain constituency, like the caller, who was maybe a voter in 2016 and maybe even 2020, and did not foresee the events of January 6th. There are a lot of people who have learned that lesson, and to keep the gas on that pedal is something that the January 6th committee was going to do.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to look at the charges they referred. The committee referred to the Department of Justice on President Trump, former President Trump. Here they are: obstructing an official proceeding, defrauding the United States, making false statements, and assisting or aiding an insurrection. What do you think of that list of referrals? One more than I think people had expected to come out of this.
It's a pretty serious list of criminal charges, right? Not official charges, as you said, but accusations, right? Based on the evidence that they found. Insurrection possibly carries with it the possibility of a 10-year jail sentence, also a disqualification from ever holding office in the United States again. The other ones are serious as well. The conspiracy to defraud has been, or obstructing an official proceeding has been used hundreds of times in the prosecution of January 6th insurrectionists or rioters. So if the people who actually listened to Donald Trump and kind of went to the Capitol and stormed the barricades were charged with that, it probably makes sense that someone, if they incited that person, would face that charge as well.
We're talking to UW Oshkosh political science professor David Seemers about the final January 6th public hearing this afternoon and the referral of criminal charges for former President Trump and others. You can join in at 800-642-1234. It's in the Department of Justice's hands now, a special counsel. Do you think former President Trump should be charged with a crime or crimes? If so, what? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with UW Oshkosh political science professor David Seemers with us today to talk about the fallout from the January 6th committee's final findings. They included a recommendation for criminal charges against former President Trump. Their full report expected to be released later this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Among those charges, as we just mentioned, the charge of insurrection. Here's Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland earlier today describing the seriousness of that charge.
It is a grave federal offense, anchored in the Constitution itself, which repeatedly opposes insurrections and domestic violence, and indeed uses participation in insurrection by office holders as automatic grounds for disqualification from ever holding public office again at the federal or state level. Anyone who incites others to engage in rebelling, assists them in doing so, or gives aid and comfort to those engaged in insurrection is guilty of a federal crime.
Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Saul is with us in Stevens Point. Saul, hi.
Hey, how are you? A couple of things, just to be a nitpicker. He said he could stand in the middle of Broadway in broad daylight and shoot somebody. And depending on how far uptown you are in Broadway, that's a lot of people have done that. My comment was I had watched a clip on, I think it was CNN, of Adam Schiff talking about, you know, the prosecution president. And he wondered at Justice Department's slow progress in its various actions against the president. And it occurred to me that I'm wondering if Merrick Garland is still considering he might be nominated to become a Supreme Court justice should something happen during Biden's term.
Saul, thanks for the call. David, the speed of the Justice Department investigation now in the hands of Special Counsel Jack Smith. I don't know if you agree with Saul's thoughts on Merrick Garland's potential future, but what do you make of the rate at which they've been doing these investigations?
Well, it's slow, but you don't charge a former president with criminal wrongdoing on the drop of a hat. It's really important that we not criminalize governance and be wary of doing so. I think that's one of the reasons for the slowness. I think that any violation that is charged criminally has to be pretty clear and readily understood by the public. And there will be many people who say that the president shouldn't be able to do anything criminal. And, you know, in theory, that is a very important stance. In practice, it's a little bit more complicated. And if you start charging presidents with criminal wrongdoing and you do that kind of immediately out of office and you do so on technicalities or laws that are pretty obscure, then you're going down a path that a lot of countries have been down and their citizens regret it. So slowness is okay at this point, I think. I would expect there to be criminal charges against the president, but that's just a guess. I would guess that they'd come out in the next couple months.
Thanks for the call, Saul. Kay joins us next in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I wanted to kind of obliquely address what the professor just said, but give a Lincoln precedent, but in reverse. During the middle of the war, Lincoln ordered arrest of a few newspaper publishers who opposed the draft. But not only did they just oppose it, they urged young men to desert. So Lincoln's response was, why should I not touch the hair on the head of a publisher when I am forced to decide which young men who deserted the Union Army to shoot? In other words, Lincoln's point was it's not just that they voiced opposition to the draft, but they urged action. So with Trump's Republican lawyers urging him to act to control, pull back the crowd, Trump's made the decision not to act to control the crowd was an action.
I see. Kay, thanks for the call. And that's something that the committee members were making a point of, former President Trump's inaction while the crowd was in the Capitol as in effect supporting that crowd. David?
Yeah, I mean, the Trump actions in the minds of the January 6th committee clearly go beyond dereliction of duty. right, making bad decisions as president, and go toward criminality. And I want to point out how extraordinary that is, because public officials have a lot of protections, not reputationally, obviously, but legally in the decisions that they make. And you have to really be egregiously criminal in order for to be charged with criminal behavior while you're in office and making decisions, or, as the caller says, non-decisions that affect people.
Okay, thanks for that call. Aaron is with us now in Marinette. Aaron, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to make a comment, kind of a general comment, that even though there's a lot of national resentment and distaste towards Donald Trump as former president, to be certain that we still uphold the ideals of innocent until proven guilty, and that any charges that would be laid against him would be done because of the facts of the situation, not because of national sentiment or some type of emotional dislike for him as a person or how he operated as a president. And that any charges that would be pressed against him, you know, they really have to consider, would it lead to a true indictment? Is there any chance at all of actually finding him guilty?
Aaron, I gotcha. Some background noise there. But David, what do you think of Aaron's point?
Yeah, those are great reminders. If he becomes a defendant, which we don't know yet, he is afforded all the rights of any criminal defendant. I would say, to go back to the charges a little bit, that the fake elector attempt or scheme to kind of have alternate slates of electors are something that this committee was really looking at and thinking about when they formulated the charges. Now, the DOJ gets this, and, like, it doesn't do anything for them, right? They've gathered their own evidence. They're making their own decisions. And if anything, it puts them in a little bit of an awkward position. So I have faith that the DOJ is doing their job slowly and methodically, and we'll see where that goes.
Thanks for that call, Aaron. And I mentioned the special counsel, Jack Smith. It seems like so far he's very much trying to not make himself a household name here. What are you watching for from him in the months to come?
Well, just a big news release someday, right? But if he decides not to prosecute or sends that recommendation on to Merrick Garland, well, it'll drop with a kind of thud, right? So Jack Smith is a very experienced prosecutor and has a terrific reputation for thoroughness, being methodical, being fair. So we'll see what comes out of that office in the next couple months.
And I wanted to mention, former President Trump has announced he's running to be future President Trump. Does the fact that he's now an announced candidate who presumably would be running against the sitting president, does that influence the Justice Department's thinking or treatment on this?
I don't think it does. Merrick Garland has said that you dole out justice without fear or favor. I think, you know, practically, we as American citizens have to be sensitive to the fact and understand that there are millions of people who are very strong proponents of Donald Trump. That's not a reason not to charge him. That's not a reason to charge him. All that occurs on the basis of evidence. But in terms of politics and the fallout of this, we've got to understand that people are going to be really upset now if the charges actually materialize. I'll just leave it there.
All right, David, and we will leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
All right, thanks. Good to be with you, Rob.
You too. That's David Siemers, professor of political science at UW Oshkosh, author of several books and articles on the Constitution and the separation of power between Congress and the president. He was with us today to recap what we heard in the final January 6th committee meeting this afternoon and where the investigation goes from there. Follow that news at WPR.org. Our colleagues at NPR, of course, are writing about that quite a bit today. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Missing people of color get less media coverage than white people do when they go missing. Kate and her guests look at some of the disparities in that coverage, where it comes from, and most importantly, the impact those disparities can have on efforts to solve these missing persons cases. Join the conversation, learn more. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. A couple weeks back, I shared the most common names for dogs in the United States, but sometimes it can be hard to tell if a name goes with a dog or a human. The Washington Post Department of Data looked at some big databases of dog and human names to answer the question, which names are more dog, more human, or a toss-up? Now forget Fido and other names that only go with dogs. They were looking for crossover names. Now here's some of the names that were equally dog and human. Jack, Angel, Cody, Hunter, Bruce, Joy, and Bonnie. But how about Max, Bella, Luna, Daisy, and Buddy? You can probably guess those are more common for dogs. George, Kevin, and Betty, not super common for anybody anymore, but they're almost certainly going to be human and not dog. And the Post has a thing where you can enter names, see where they fall. I tried variants of my name. Robert, all human, all the time. Bobby, mostly human, but Rob and Robbie, it's a toss-up. Pretty sure I'm human. This is Central Time.